This episode of the City Manager Unfiltered podcast is sponsored by citymanagernews.com. It is the only place to go if you're looking for news, industry insights, transitions, and a job board related to the city and county management profession. Check it out today. That is citymanagernews.com. In this episode, we're going to talk to Bradley Ford. He is the city manager for Waco, Texas, and he's also the owner of City Compensation, a new project that he's launched related to executive level compensation in the public sector. I had originally planned to have C.J. Grisham, the attorney who was escorted out of the Aransas Pass, Texas council meeting recently and threatened with arrest after he dropped a dozen F-bombs. We were going to talk about the First Amendment and freedom of speech and public comment periods. However, the contract signed by Taylor Tedder in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, blew up the feed this week, and it's been the topic of conversation amongst our peers. And so me and Bradley decided to break this down and talk about his contract, and I think you're going to really enjoy the episode. So before we get into it, also a reminder, don't forget that Micah Gaudet and I, we're going to be having a special announcement on May 1st. We're going to be announcing a project that we're working on. And if you're listening to this podcast, there's a really, really good chance, a really good shot that you're going to want to hear that you're really going to be intrigued by what we're working on. So stay tuned for that special May 1st announcement by Micah Gaudet and I. And here we go. Let's jump into this episode. I think you're going to really enjoy it. All right. I'm Joe Turner, and this is the City Manager Unfiltered podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. It is the most influential local government podcast in America, and this is going to be a really interesting show, first of its kind. We are going to deconstruct a contract of one of our peers, Taylor Tedder, over in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. I have a special guest with us today. His name is Bradley Ford. He is the city manager for Waco, Texas. And Bradley, why don't you briefly introduce yourself and we'll jump into this thing. I'm really excited about this episode and curious to see where it's going to go.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Great to be on. It's been a long time coming. I'm Bradley Ford. I serve as Waco's city manager. Been in Waco for 7 years. Been city manager there for coming up on 4 years. I've spent 20 years in local government in the Texas Triangle. So I started with the city of Fort Worth right out of college, and then did 5 years there and did 9 years in Burleson, Texas, just the south of Fort Worth. So kind of just working that Texas Triangle and loving local government.
Hey, I'm happy to have you. You know, Bradley, I hope you don't get embarrassed when I say this, because you literally epitomize one of the core values or beliefs that I have and what I've been trying to accomplish with this podcast and with the LinkedIn platform. And what I mean by that is I've talked about community, the importance of community, creating connectedness for city managers. I've talked about personal professional development and advocacy for the professional managers. And you connected with me. You reached out to me way back in December of 2022. I probably had fewer than a thousand followers at that point in time. And here, Bradley Ford, city manager, town of 150,000, reaches out to some dude who's got, you know, 2,500 people he's working for in small South Hutchinson, Kansas. And you didn't big time me or anything like that. You reached out to me and you said, hey, I really appreciate what you're doing, the community you're building. And you're just really supportive of me. And I wanted to express my gratitude and appreciation for that.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun to watch you from December 22, because it's been like a rocket ship, man. It's been blowing up. And I think it's because the community and local government needs a voice that's willing to try and connect people and also talk about issues that are, not fun to talk about, whether it's contracts, whether it's severance, whether it's associations. You know, there's things that need a forum, and you've really dove into that.
I appreciate that. You know, and you literally walk the walk and don't just talk the talk. And I mean that with absolute sincerity, because you do a lot of things behind the scenes that a lot of folks aren't aware of when it comes to supporting your peers, and you don't ask for any recognition for it. I'll give you a couple examples, and I hope you don't mind, but you know, our buddy Daniel Rosemont, I had him on the show, and I put out a call to those listening to reach out and offer him some help if you had any work you could offer up for him, like, you know, help him get on his feet and what have you. And I learned later after the fact from Daniel that you were one of the managers that reached out and helped them. And so thank you very much.
Yeah, for sure, Joe. I think there's so much talent in the local government community. City managers are talented people. And Daniel's a great example. He needed support, but more than that, it wasn't a charity thing, right?
Right.
He's very talented. And so, yeah, he's helping us kind of strategize on our ARPA spending plan related to housing here in Waco. And he's actually getting close to finishing up his work. And it's been a pleasure to work with him. And same thing with, you know, with Micah Gaudet. I think we've got 7 or 8 people that have been through his AI course so far in the city of Waco. And it's really stimulated conversations around how can we make use of this tool. So
right.
Just it's incredible, man. There's so much talent in local government. And so it's a pleasure to be able to support these individuals.
Yeah, awesome. I know you were the very first city manager in Texas to reach out to Micah and get some staff trained up on it. And I mean, that's just a testament to your innovative thinking, your progressive outlook on the profession and trying to be as efficient and as effective as you can with our taxpayer dollars. So yeah, I hold you in very high regard. You're not the only manager that's reached out to me. I some big timers, and I got Howard Chan in Sacramento. Again, this is way back in December. Earlier than that, before I was, again, I didn't have a podcast. There was nothing for me to offer anybody really, but, you know, Howard Chan in Sacramento and David Ellis in Wake County, just amazing guys out there who said, hey, really appreciate what you're doing. And it meant a lot to me. So it was a great opportunity for me to thank them and you. And thanks again for being on the show. Bradley, you've started a project called City Compensation. We're going to talk about this in a little bit more detail, but there's kind of a funny story when it comes to this, because way back in December of 2022, when I was doing the LinkedIn and building the platform, I had this sort of in the infancy of it, an idea of building a database or a repository of city manager contracts from across the country. And I started reaching out and doing public information requests for contracts in California, is where I started. That's where I'm from, and I know the process pretty well. And then I managed to secure something like 350 contracts of managers out there. And I got nearly the entire state. And I was like, man, this is a lot of hard work. And so I kind of put it on the shelf. And then you reached out to me relatively recently. In fact, we were going to have you on the podcast back in December, but, you know, scheduling conflicts happened. And you said, hey, unbeknownst to what I was doing, you said, hey, Joe, I've started this project called City Compensation. Why don't you unpack it a little bit? And then we'll dive into it in more detail at the end of the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. It is funny that we've tracked along some parallel paths, and I think that's just confirming to say city managers need a resource. But City Compensation is it's a local government specific compensation database, and to date, it's got over 1,000 cities in it, 14,000 jobs. I think tracking north of $2 billion worth of wages. It's just for local government leadership. So department heads and up, city managers, assistant city managers, city attorneys, all those positions for 1,000 different cities across the country. And it's pretty eye-opening. We'll get into it later, just how much variation there is and how much we need to be talking about compensation in particular, because it varies so widely.
So not to pat ourselves on our own back here, but I think it's safe to say that you and I are probably in the top 1% when it comes into the number of contracts we've looked at and reviewed in this profession, right? I mean, I've looked at hundreds and hundreds. You've looked at, I think, thousands at this point, maybe. Yeah.
Way too many.
Yeah. Yeah. And so with that said, that's the precursor or the setup for this conversation. When I learned about Taylor Tedder's contract in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, a couple of days ago, literally my jaw hit the floor when I read it, because I'd never seen anything like it. And I actually texted Taylor through LinkedIn. We're not super close, so I like it. We've had interactions in the past and what have you. And I said, dude, this is a monumental shift in the paradigm when it comes to city manager compensation. I'm not sure if you're even aware how significant this is. And he goes, I really wasn't until I read your post a couple of days ago, because coincidentally on LinkedIn, I'd posted about city manager housing, the need for some cities to start purchasing housing for managers, the impact of, and I've talked about it for months now, the impact of housing and buying and selling has on managers. How significant is this contract in your opinion, when it comes to the city management profession, Bradley?
I mean, there's nothing that I've seen like it so far with a city signing up for a home loan that's forgivable. I mean, there's lots of cities that have housing stipends. There's lots of cities that do somewhat creative things around this issue, especially like resort towns and coastal cities. But I don't have any that have the level of benefit that Taylor and Rehoboth Beach have put in. And so I do think it's significant. And I think it definitely is significant for managers that are in looking to serve in real expensive housing areas. Beyond that, though, I think it also has some interesting implications for every city manager to think through.
I agree 100%. And we can unpack that a little bit. So, you know, I've seen contracts and situations, especially in California, where city managers will get home loans. Usually they're in the form of a low interest loan, even sometimes a zero interest loan. I think I've seen here and there. And I've even seen some situations, Bradley, where contracts will have some forgiveness of some of the loans, but usually in the form of like a down payment assistance program forgiveness, nothing of the magnitude of a full forgiveness of a home loan after 7 years or any period of time.
Yeah, especially not at the value, you know, I think the value in that contract is $750,000. You know, that's real money.
Right? Yes.
And you know, Taylor didn't sign a bad deal from his compensation standpoint either. You know, the Northeast, in our city compensation tool, the Northeast has the lowest compensation for city managers in the five regions we track. And so Taylor's comp at 250, I think it was 250.
Yes. Yep.
Is actually pretty good. And then you factor in this benefit of the, you know, the forgivable loan. And, you know, that's $100,000 to $130,000 of comp a year, yeah, on top of his $250,000.
Yep. Yep. It's an average annualized increase of what, $112,000, something like that.
And that is a really strong, yeah, compensation package for somebody up in the Northeast, where city managers just are not compensated the same as their peers in other regions.
Well, let's talk about the Northeast. You know, my wife, she's wanted me to look for jobs up in the Northeast a little bit. And I tell her, the compensation sucks, relatively speaking, and the housing's super expensive. So you're getting double whammied. And I'm like, why do I want to go up there and do that when you can go someplace else and get a better wage and a much lower cost of housing? So I think it's a very interesting situation to see. I would love to know. I mean, I'm going to try to get, I don't know if Taylor would ever come on, because obviously the public nature of everything too, but I would love to get a better understanding or clarity as far as how this even originated, what the thought process was for coming up with this compensation idea, because I love it. I think it's, man, if you are looking to have a city manager commit to your area and you want to get rid of turnover and you're tired of the churn and the impact it's having in your organization, Taylor has every incentive in the world to stay in Rehoboth Beach. And in fact, we messaged and he said, you know, he hopes to find a forever home. I think he wants to be there for the rest of his career, honestly.
That's great. And he's a young guy.
Yeah.
Right. In his 30s, I think. So I feel like it's a great mix between Taylor betting on himself.
Uh-huh.
And being confident that he can last 4 to 7 years or more and get the big benefit of this provision. But it's also the governing body saying, hey, we want somebody to be here a while.
Yeah. I mean,
when those two things mix, when you can get both of those energies going in the same direction, it's going to be great for their community.
Taylor's going to be there a long time. And with his choosing, right? I mean, he's going to be there a long time because he has every incentive to stay. I mean, the idea that you could be in some place after 7 years and have a house free and clear and making a good living in a community in a, you know, I've never been to that area of the country, but I assume it's pretty beautiful. It's a resort community, as I understand it. People have been, you know, calling me up and messaging me since this whole thing broke. I've been getting tons of messages on it. So there's no question that Taylor is going to be in alignment with the council and has every incentive of trying to crush that job and do everything he can to satisfy the council, get those objectives and those goals met and so forth and so on. Let's talk a little bit about the contract in more detail. We both have looked at it. We've both seen it. And I was wondering if there's anything that immediately stood out to you about it. obviously, well, besides the actual, you know, what we're talking about. I mean, but
yeah, I think, you know, first thing I look at on the contract, of course, I take a look at the salary and where it kind of sits, and Taylor's looking pretty good. And the benefit of the housing is great, no doubt. I think that it starts to kick in maybe in year four.
That's correct. Yep. When he gets a 15% forgiveness.
And then escalates through, you know, full the through the full forgiveness. That's, you know, that's not to critique something that's really a great benefit and cause for the ground to shake a little bit, for sure. You know, that's an area where perhaps, you know, you could pull that forward a little more. But from watching city managers, and you've highlighted this too, by the way, watching city managers and when they move, most city managers that make it to 2 years are going to make it to five. You know, I'm tracking hundreds of city managers now, and the average tenure in the database is 5.5 years.
Okay.
But what seems to be the theme is a lot of people flaming out in the 1 to 2 years.
Yeah, range. Early. Yep. Yep.
And if you get past that 1 to 2 years, you've got an opportunity for good tenure. So hopefully that's what happens for Taylor and regarding to the housing benefit. But beyond that, I think, you know, the way he structured, or they structured, deferred comp is good. You know, kind of grows over time as well.
Have you seen that before either? I don't know if I've seen that either. I thought that was another kind of unique provision, but I don't think it's obviously not as unique as the housing, but what, I mean, I guess I'll unpack that a little bit. What you're looking at is the city is going to give 5% of a salary to a retirement plan. And then over the first year, and then each successive year, it upticks by additional percent and caps out at 10% after 5 years.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are examples of that in other contracts with deferred comp as well as with time earned, mm-hmm. and things like that. And I like those provisions, because every community has a context that a manager has to operate in, especially if they've never had a contract provision. For instance, if they've never done deferred comp in a community, you have to kind of start with what you can get, right, and then earn your way up to a full benefit. And that looks like kind of what's happening here with Taylor, is he's going to take him 5 years to get to kind of what is the maximum benefit for deferred comp. So I like that kind of provision, especially in a community where, you know, maybe they haven't had a contract before, or maybe they've had a real weak contract from the manager's perspective. You kind of have to start with where you can get and bet on yourself.
Yeah.
So I like it when I see things like that. Sure, it would be better to have a guaranteed maximum contribution on a 457, and a lot of managers have that.
Right.
And the really good contracts on deferred comp, they don't set a value. They just say it's going to be the maximum IRS contribution to a 457, so that the manager's not going back having to renegotiate. Is it going to be 25,000 this year, or 27 right. next? It just floats up with the maximum contribution. So that's an area where, you know, Taylor's is good and probably could get better over time with a little more, you know, as he renegotiates over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Moving down the line, and we're going to come back to housing in a minute, because I have a lot more to unpack on that. I'm sure you do too. But looking at his insurance, 3 times his salary. I don't know if that's unusual for him or in that city, or if that's just primarily based off of the housing function of the home loan or what's going on there. But it's not super common to see 3 times your salary for life insurance on a contract. More often than not, I see a 1 year, or I see sometimes I'll see two times the amount. But I don't think I really see 3 times very often.
Yeah, it would be 3x of annual salary would be like in the top 5%.
Yeah,
from what I'm tracking, there's not many that, like you said, it's normally a 1 to 2x. You're probably right. There was probably some conversations around, okay, we need to ensure repayment on this loan if something tragic were to happen.
Yeah. And take care of his wife if, you know, something happens there. Yeah.
So I think you're probably on target there, given some of the other language that's in that housing provision on repayment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're probably right.
The vehicle allowance, I think it's solid. I mean, it's not in the upper end, but it's definitely not in the lower end. It's $750 a month. I still think a vehicle allowance or something that on the whole, I think they're really undervalued in terms of by the managers, and they need to be bumped up because, you know, you look at a pricing out a vehicle. If you just want to add a vehicle to the fleet and make it available for a manager, you're going to be spending more than $750 a month on the actual cost of the vehicle plus the fuel in and of itself. So I really think that's something that we as managers probably need to do a better job overall. I mean, I'm not knocking the 750 because I think it's in the upper half of the distribution amongst our peers. But I do think that when it comes to city managers as a whole, we're not getting enough of the vehicle allowance that we probably should be getting in relation to what the actual cost would be to the city if they were to have to provide a vehicle to us.
Yeah, for sure. I think that this is an area where cities in the South and Southwest and West are much more aggressive on than the Northeast and Midwest, for instance. And when you're talking $7,000 to $12,000 in a compensation package, it matters.
Yeah.
And certainly, as you say, with the cost of what a car runs these days, you know, you got to be thinking. But you're right. He's kind of middle of the road from a city manager standpoint of what managers get for car allowances.
They're also densely, pretty densely populated over there in the Eastern, mid-Atlantic seaboard and stuff too. So it's not like he's driving, I'm sure, a lot of places. I would think there's probably, that they consider as well.
Yeah, there are, one of the interesting, I do have a section on car allowances in the report. And
when you say report, by the way, what he's talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is that he, on city compensation, he puts together customized reports for the cities that ask for a compensation analysis package, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so I did spend some time on car allowances because it just feels like one that everybody knows they're there, but they don't talk about how much they're worth and who all gets them. But it's 550 city managers that get it out of the 850 in the report. So the predominant portion, it's not everybody though. There's 300 city managers out there not getting a car allowance.
Right.
So walking away from $10,000 to $12,000 a year, really.
Well, but in all fairness, though, are you that granular where you know whether or not they're getting an actual city provided vehicle? Is that generally what's going on? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's not. Generally, unless they're doing, going by what's in their contract. A few of them do note the city provided car, but by and large, it's not referenced.
Gotcha.
In the 300 I'm talking about, it's not referenced.
Gotcha. So. I'm tracking you now. Okay.
Yeah. But, I try to get as granular. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, it's a lot of work to get that granular, but the idea was to try and create a value for the city manager to say, okay, it's comparable across the entire country. And I know what my value is and I know what I should be negotiating for. And to do that takes a lot of reading, takes a lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When you go to the next down, we're looking at cell phone. Cell phone compensation has been a little bit of an interesting deal. I think there's an evolution on this. And when I look at contracts, Bradley, there's the traditional treatment of a cell phone where you just get $50 to $100 a month for the cell phone. But, cell phones have gotten really expensive. I've seen some of the cell phone language turn more towards a technology equipment type language. You combine with working remotely and people having home offices. I've seen a push to try to one of my contracts, actually, when I did in South Hutchinson, is I asked for a home office allowance to some degree. What are your thoughts on where that's shaken out in the current dynamics of city manager compensation when it comes to cell phone, home technology equipment, and home offices?
Yeah, there's really two categories of cities in my mind here. There's the category that require you to hold a city device.
Right.
And there's the category of what looks like for Taylor, where he does not have to hold a city device. He holds a personal device only.
No. They mentioned they give him a laptop and an iPad, but
on the cell phone side.
On the cell phone side, he has his own cell phone. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's a particular, personally, particular bone in, or a burr in my saddle, to use a Texas term, because I hate carrying two cell phones. I really do. So I have my personal phone and my city phone, and just don't like it. But looks like Taylor's going to carry one phone. That's nice. I think it's a little light on the 60 a month is a little light.
Yeah.
More in line to, you know, $1,000 a year is probably your bogey on a cell phone. Or if you, some cities do where they'll give you your monthly service fee of, say, like, let's use Taylor's 60. And then they'll also once a year give him a $500 one-time device acquisition
right
fee. And that helps them pay for that expensive phone.
Right. Or the peripherals that go with it for chargers and stuff like that. Right. Yeah. I would talk to the managers who are listening. I think that we need to start being a little bit more pushing on the home office allowance type deal. You know, they won't, you know, this is not a 9-to-5 job, obviously. And I think if you're going to have a home office and you're working, then I think it's fair to ask for some compensation in that regard. Let's move on down again. And we're not losing track of the home. We're going to come back to that. But again, just kind of moving down the contract here, my notes, you know, you got the language on outside activities, which I think is always kind of interesting. This idea that you're going to limit what you can and can't do as a manager. This says basically that he cannot engage in any other business activity, whether or not such activity is pursued for profit, except they've carved out an exclusion for him to be an adjunct professor with Wichita State or whatnot. Do you have any thoughts on that? Anything stand out to you about that?
Well, I think that is the kind of template, what I'll call template language,
right,
that serves city well. I see a lot of these similar phrasings, and I think that those are going to need to get worked over in the coming years. Managers teach, they speak, they want to have side hustles, they want to do things that are fun to them and give them energy. And so tightening up the template language being so tight is an area where I think managers are going to have to do some work. And I'm glad Taylor gets to do his teaching deal at Wichita Falls or Wichita State. Sorry.
That's just a Texas and you coming out right there. That's just a Texas.
Yeah, sorry. But, you know, that there needs to be, especially for those managers that want to do creative things that give them energy outside the local government, you got to open it up. You got to open up that language on outside activities. You can keep the things like it won't become a distraction.
Yeah.
It won't
impair your ability to do the job. Yada, yada. Yeah.
Those are important. Those need to be there. And I have seen some cities doing that where they're opening up the ability of the manager to be more entrepreneurial. But it is not the standard. It's not the template. So there's still some room to go here.
Especially in this day and age where you have the digital economy and the internet where you can do so many things now. Just the opportunities are so expansive nowadays for managers to do on their own time. And the language on this too, Bradley, just kind of caught me off guard, was says whether or not such activities pursued for profit. Well, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like really kind of vague language. I don't think Taylor's really sweating it right now. I mean, at the end of the day, he's when you have a contract that has the housing incentive that he's got, his full focus is going to be on this job, obviously. I mean, he's going to be trying to crush it. So moving on, I see, you know, what was interesting, I don't know anything about Rehoboth Beach in the area. Again, I've never been out that part of the country. He's getting this housing allowance and it still gives him the latitude of being within 15 miles. So, I mean, I've heard housing in the city itself can be seven figures and up. So I guess maybe that's what the allotment's for. But I thought that was still pretty interesting that even with that housing incentive, he has the ability to live 15 miles outside the community.
That's one of the things that makes this provision, when you combine this, the residency provision and the deferrable loan together, is really unique.
Yeah.
Really unique.
So we got the moving, and then we got the moving relocation. This was interesting to me too, because this is a pretty high number. I don't think I've seen a $50,000 number, at least like this, okay? But what's going on here, when I read Section 8 of the contract, it says, the city shall pay up to $50,000 toward moving and relocation expenses for the city manager and his family. I'm interpreting this to mean that they've rolled in a temporary housing allotment into this so he has time to move to the area and take his time to find out where he wants to live. So this is going to be going to also offset some of his temporary housing costs. That's how I'm interpreting that. And I see most often I see contracts where it has the moving expense reimbursed with a separate line item for the temp housing or whatnot. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I'm just kind of scanning the report here. Typically these are in two buckets. A relocation in one bucket, temporary housing in a second bucket. In the event of this contract with Taylor, it's 50 for both. That would put him on par with you know, like City of Dallas did a $35,000 relo on their last manager with $18,000 going to temp housing, $53,000. That's on the very upper end of what I'm seeing. And so Taylor's, that's a really good benefit.
Yeah, yeah. And a note, it's for actual expense. He doesn't just get a $50,000 blank check. He's got to actually have expense. But still, I think they're doing really solid by him. You know, you look at this whole process on this contract, and honestly, I feel like they're doing right by him in the grand scheme of things. There's a major quibble I have with this contract. We're going to come back to, but let's move on now. Let's see. You know, Warren Hutmacher, I think I got his name right. He's the out in Georgia. He used to be the Hutto city manager for a time in Texas, but he's out in Georgia doing consulting with Sumpter Consulting. He started his own shop, hanging his own shingle. You know, one of the things he harps on a lot, and I harp on it, but he's almost like the patron saint of harping on this, in my opinion, in a good way, is he talks about termination clauses and not having them be vague and subjective. And when I look at the termination clause for this contract, I feel it's a pretty good shape here for Taylor. I have a little quibble on it, but by and large, he has to actually be convicted of something serious in order to basically be terminated. You can't just terminate for cause because of something subjective.
Yeah, that should be the, when you're starting, especially your first city manager gig, that should be where you start. I think Warren's onto something, and the vast majority of contracts I'm reading are vague on for cause. It just says for cause. It doesn't define it as a crime or malfeasance. So I think Taylor's in good shape here. I think I don't know if the quibble is in 13.1c.
You got me.
If you're not going to talk about it, I would like to.
Why don't you go ahead, Bradley? I'll let you roll with that one. Why don't you go ahead and talk about 13.1c, because I'm always the IC made bad guy.
So I mean, Taylor's not the only one with this in his contract. So don't want Taylor to feel singled out in this, but 13.1c says, you know, it's a for cause event that a city manager violation of the ICMA's code of ethics would make a for cause event, which would impact his ability to collect severance. It'll impact him, his ability on the time he's going to be paid out for. It has serious implications for this contract. And, you know, there's, I would say about half the contracts I've seen have something similar to this, that either say the manager shall adhere to the code of ethics from ICMA, or it shall be a for cause event if they don't. That really releases a lot of power from the manager's standpoint, but also from the governing body standpoint.
Yes.
Into the hands of an outside entity that may not know your situation very well.
Yeah, I think you're being very kind with that. Obviously, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you know I have an issue with the ICMA when it comes to their application of the code of ethics. I think it's applied in a partisan fashion. I think it's applied inconsistently. I think it's applied unfairly at times. The James Freed situation is an example. I don't think any city manager should have a contract that says a violation of the ICMA code of ethics can result in a termination for cause. I vehemently disagree with that. This contract also, which I skipped over it because I didn't want to go on an anti-ICMA rant, but this contract also requires him to be a member of the ICMA, and I have a problem with that. But you know, this contract is what I would call, Bradley, and I'm kind of new to the game. I've only been in the profession now for about a handful of years, but this is what I would call the ICMA recruiter industrial complex, where the recruiters are going out, they're ICMA members, they allow them to have the CM credential. They're telling these governing bodies that you need to have somebody with an ICMA CM credential, or you should try to get that. They're the ones that are putting this language in there, because most of the governing bodies don't really know much about the ICMA or anything like that. So this is all being put in by managers who have this ICMA affiliation. And really, when you stop and think about it, this does not benefit the manager. And this should not. So you have managers that are pushing this ICMA agenda type deal on contracts and in the whole recruitment space. That's not really beneficial to the managers, in my opinion.
No, it's definitely not. And I think the things that would cause me, I think 10 years ago, I wouldn't have had this feeling.
I think that's fair.
More recently, with the lack of explanation out of some of the things that you've referred to from ICMA's standpoint. It feels like it's gone into a black box, and there's not been explanations around. I mean, just some of the commentary that was printed on the James Freed situation, some of the ethics board members that, you know, walked into a room with some preconceived ideas about James Freed that don't feel fair or right. I think you have to question whether you want to subject yourself to a group that might have a misperception of you or a predetermined perception of you. So I believe that,
or a politically biased and motivated problem with you because they don't like your politics. You know, I got a problem. You know, sorry, I didn't mean to go on this whole rant here, Bradley, but you kind of got me tuned up now. You know, when Ray Beret, the chief of staff for Mark Ott, the CEO of the ICMA, can make political contributions to a presidential campaign and to Democrat PACs and what have you, and that's an explicit violation of Tenet 7, as far as I understand it, and there's no consequence, there's no punishment, there's no public statement, there's nothing coming out of with an apology, nothing like that. And you mean to tell me that if Taylor was to make a campaign contribution and violate Tenet 7, that he could lose his job because of this language? I find that egregiously inappropriate and unacceptable.
Yeah, and it's not a choice between no ethics and the ICMA ethics, because other managers have incorporated language that's like, there's an ethical requirement. For instance, in Enid, Oklahoma, there's an ethical requirement. It's just not tied to the ICMA process.
Okay.
Or in Wiley, Texas, they have their own ethics requirements in their city. And so it refers to their own ethics requirements. And that's really where I think managers ought to consider going, because really it's the governing body. It's their bosses that should
hold them accountable, right?
Be determining that. And because I think one thing when we talk about ICMA code of ethics, you know, it's not a choice of we're not going to have any ethics requirement. It's really, well, we want to think about, Who's the governing body, really? It's your city council. That's who should be determining if you had an ethical violation. Right. They understand your local context. They understand what their expectations of the manager are. And they're the ones that should adjudicate that.
Well, it's funny you say that, because in the James Freed case, for example, you got to remember, the ICMA loves to parachute in and basically insert themselves into the city manager's local community as far as dropping press releases, sending letters to the governing body, so forth and so on, right? James Freed is a classic example. Now, they won't comment on their own situation, right? Well, their own house is not in order. And I'm sorry I'm getting wound up on this, but you got me tuned up, Bradley, because they won't comment on their own situation. Mum's the word. They won't, you know, when you got William Frazier, right? And you got Pamela Antill talking about punching James Freed in the face, call him a douchebag in text messages. They do not come out and hold themselves accountable. There's no public there's no public apology issued. There's no public statement issued whatsoever by the CEO, by the exec board. Nobody condemns it. Nobody disapproves of it. Nothing. It's just absolute silence. But then James Freed, they don't like what he does. They go in and parachute in, and they basically light him up with his counsel and try to get him fired, right? That's one example. And his government body said, go pound sand. We don't give a damn what you guys say about our manager, because he's doing what we want him to do, right? And then I don't want to put her on blast, because I think she wants to keep a low profile. But in New Rochelle, you have an assistant to the city manager who was recently publicly censured by the ICMA, and they go in and parachute in. Now, she screwed up. She violated the rules. Okay, whatever. But she violated the rules. They go in and parachute in. They got a newspaper article written. She's got a Google footprint now about her violating the code of ethics, all this other crap. But yet, Ray Beret, the number two man in the organization who works for the CEO, who worked for him in Austin, can do whatever the hell he wants, and there's no punishment. There's no consequence. Pisses me off. Sorry. We probably should move on from this conversation to the next topic. Sorry, Bradley.
Well, let me give you a data point, and it might be helpful.
Okay.
You know, there's only about half of the contracts that require that align their ethical requirement to the ICMA's policies. So there are about half of the managers that are going with either, there's some that you do like a state code of ethics they refer to, some that do local, and then some that are silent around the ethical requirement. So it's about half that have that the similar situation to Taylor, in that he's going to be subject to the ICMA code of ethics.
Okay.
But I do think folks ought to consider who they want to be the final adjudicator of their
livelihood.
Seems like, you know, kind of like the whole saying that government closest to the people is serves better. I'm butchering that quote, but seems like you'd want your governing body determining if you had an ethical violation or not.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's move on. I'm going to move on to section 13.2. This is the notice provision, because this caught my attention, Bradley. And this is something that one of my two major quibbles with this contract is that in the notice of provision, it says that the city manager must provide a minimum of 60 days notice of intention to terminate employment. But I don't see a reciprocal requirement on the part of the city, not unless I missed it, to provide notification to the manager that they don't want to, that they want to terminate the contract. Essentially, they can just vote whenever they want to terminate him, and that's it. He gets 6 months, and that's it. You know, and I think he should have a notice in there if they want a notice, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, it seems like you would have that. And this may be another byproduct of that kind of template contract that goes out. Most...
You mean the crappy one that the ICMA has?
Yeah. Most city managers do have the resignation notice requirement, like 85% of them. And it's timed between 30 on the low end. On the high end, I've got one in here at 180 days. They've got to get 180 days notice. City manager does, which is nuts. Don't agree to that.
How do you get hired for your next job?
Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, I'll be there next year.
Yeah.
I'll be there next year. and then on the council side, the vast majority's contracts have no requirement on timing. And so there's a little bit of there's some equilibrium that needs to come to that conversation.
Yeah. And I talked about that a little bit in episode 2 of my podcast, when I talk about the negotiation of your contract, your key objective. So before we get back to housing, because I have some more thoughts I want to share on that, is there anything else you want to talk about with respect to this particular contract, Bradley, that caught your attention, or did we cover it all?
No, I think we covered it all. I really liked the living outside the city, perhaps giving him the flexibility. That's one that not a lot of folks have, especially in coastal or high housing burden cities. I think they've got to move off of that residency requirement.
Yeah.
So just really appreciated seeing that. But no, we've covered.
For one more thing, I wanted to mention before we get to the housing part, he does get a starting with 80 hours of vacation at the initial commencement of his contract. I do think that's something that managers should be cognizant of. And I think it was great for him to get those 2 weeks.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a good one. You should always get preloaded vacation time. And the other one
why is that, Bradley? Why don't you expand on that for the people who are saying, why is that?
You know, you don't want to wait for a year to go on vacation.
Right.
Right.
Well, now
you don't want to start at 0 hours and feel like you're always behind.
And we're in a transient occupation. The volatility, we move around. So it's like you don't have the benefit of having that accrued time of service with the organization. So you're more like making a lateral transfer in my opinion, and you should get that benefit. So.
And I'm reading into this provision, but I'm assuming the other thing that Taylor got is that he's accruing at the highest rate of any employee, because he's accruing at 160 hours, right?
Yes.
And so you should always walk in with a preload of 80 to 160 hours, and then also be accruing at the fastest rate of any other employee. And I see that a lot. And I think that given the nature of the profession, you should have that. Yeah. Another spot I think we ought to look at for a minute, Joe, is 4.4 on health, dental, disability insurance.
Okay. What do you see there?
You know, he's provided the same insurance terms as full-time city employees, which is pretty typical. And then the city's going to pick up 90% of his health insurance cost for himself, the manager, as well as his spouse.
Right.
And that seems like a very easy thing to negotiate for managers, but not very many are doing that. So they're...
What are you seeing? Because sometimes I see, for example, the manager will get 100% paid for, and the spouse will get some percentage, or the spouse and family will get some percentage. I don't see anything here about his children. I'm not sure what's going on there. I think he has children. Yeah. So,
well, then certainly when he goes back in to renegotiate, he needs to say full family and 100% coverage.
Yeah.
I really do feel like this is an easy one to ask for, and it has real value to the manager. You know, whether that's $7,000 to $8,000 a year, $10,000 a year value, you ought to get paid healthcare coverage. looking at kind of the data set, it's less than half that of managers that do that.
What do you mean? They're only getting themselves covered, but not the spouse and the family?
Oh no. Let's see. Let me do a little query here. So about 30% do not get paid healthcare. About 20% do for themselves only.
Uh-huh.
And then the balance is those that I think get the gold standard, which is full family paid for by the city.
That's kind of shocking, honestly. I didn't expect that.
I think there's some space here for managers to really
dial in.
Go ahead and ask for that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I said, I think it depends on your plan, but that's a $7,000 to $10,000 benefit annualized.
Okay. Awesome. Great observation. Let's turn our attention to the housing now. So I love, don't mistake anything I'm going to say. This is like groundbreaking as far as this contract's concerned. So we're really kind of getting nitpicky here. I do, when I look at the structure of the way the forgiveness is done on the debt, I do have some concerns, Bradley, that as this contract moves forward in time, the average annual value of the contract increases significantly. And it's almost like it creates a perverse incentive on some parts of the council at some point to maybe decide to fire him and basically free them of that obligation, that financial liability. Because the way it's staggered right now is that he gets 15% after year four, and then he gets 15% after let me see my notes here. Mm-hmm. He gets 15% after year four, another 15% after the fifth anniversary, and then it bumps up to 30% and 40% respectively in the final 2 years. So those final two out years are massive, right?
Yeah.
And the language says that if he gets terminated for any reason, so if he gets terminated without cause, he loses that benefit. And that really, I have some concern about that.
Yeah, I think for good reason, right? I mean, given that this is an outlier, there's nothing really to benchmark to, but ideally Taylor would have had some benefit earlier in that time, or maybe more spread out the,
like, percentage. Equally distribute the use, the
maybe that. So if managers are looking to, you know, take this as a template, that's something that would be preferred, so that you don't create a disincentive late in the game to have a manager move on because the liability that's there.
Exactly. Like, for example, in this case, I think there should be language that if it's you're fired without cause, there should be some way for you to get a pro rata share of the forgiveness, for example. So if you're fired after year three for without cause, again, no fault of your own, right? Just at their convenience, then I think you should get 3/7 forgiveness, for example, you know?
Yeah, I think those are great changes that, you know, like you said earlier, it's hindsight, it's 2020 for Taylor, but as we look forward to hopefully a lot of people down the coasts of Florida and maybe even some West Coast cities, some mountain resort cities that might start using this
right.
frequently, that's something that managers ought to be looking at.
Yeah.
Is not creating a disincentive for their future employment.
Yeah, because you want there to be alignment, right? Right now, the way this contract is structured, Taylor is heavily incentivized to stay there for 7+ years. I mean, this is the most incentivized contract I've seen for a manager to keep them locked in a place and have that stability, right? My concern is just that as you go into the out years, the council seemingly does not have that same there might be a same in theory alignment for wanting stability and having the manager in place, but there's a financial motivation to perhaps punt and get someone else new at some point, especially if there's an election, there's a council change or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the other thing on this provision that's, you know, it's challenging to think through, what if it goes bad?
Yes.
And I'm sure Taylor and the governing body have thought a lot about that. And like you said earlier, maybe he'll hop on and talk through it, but the section that talks about when the loan will become due, for instance, it'll become due and payable if he voluntarily resigns within 60 days.
Yes.
So I don't know, Taylor, maybe he's sitting on a huge amount of money, but what if he's not able to sell that home in 60 days? He's looking for a conversion of the mortgage, I guess.
Excellent observation, Bradley, because that was going to be the next thing on my list to talk about, because phenomenal observation, right? Because one, if you're going to resign and you're going to voluntarily move on, then I think I can understand there'd be a shorter period of time which you have to pay that loan back, right? But if you're going to be fired without cause again, 60 days is not a long time to go and get the house sold, right? Especially if you're talking about, I mean, here's the thing, okay? 60 days period is just not a lot of time, one. So if you can't sell the house in 60 days, are you simultaneously on trying to get financing in place for you to live there? And no, by the way, how do you get financing when you've just lost your job and you don't have proof of income coming in? And that is very concerning in that regard. So you make a very phenomenal, a very insightful observation there, Bradley, because I think there should be a larger gap in time. Or even this, or even if you want to barter with the governing body in this sense, you say, okay, then it converts to upon termination of or whatever cause, maybe it converts to a rental payback or a monthly compensation for a certain period of time to buy you time to get your ducks in a row and move, because all these moving pieces.
Yeah, I think that's a great solution there, Joe, is like the conversion. You have to be careful not to lose the equity value that, because I mean, a part of the benefit to Taylor is, let's say he buys a $750,000 house, and over those 5 years, it's going to increase in value, right? So he gets the value of the forgivable loan, but he also gets the value of the home.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, there's got to be an off ramp here that
It's in some respects, Bradley, it's like you can just give the house back. Right. Because you're not going to be out anything. Right? Because here's the other fascinating thing about this provision, this contract, is he's not required to make any payments towards the debt reduction throughout the entire life of the loan. So if he's there for 7 years, not only is he getting this benefit, he doesn't even have a monthly housing expense. It's a phenomenal. I mean, this is an amazing contract in that regard. And again, I'm not trying to dump on it at all. We're just trying to look at some of the pitfalls. And here's the deal. He's the first one through the breach, right? Like, you know, I'm jokingly referring to him as the patron saint of like the first patron saint of the International Brotherhood of City Managers. Like he's, you know what I mean? So yeah. It's like, he's the first one through the breach, right? And we're going to have a lot to now learn and how to reshape this and find out the rough edges, right? As far as this is concerned. So I'm not trying to look like our nitpicky, but hey, just some things here in place. But you know, he doesn't even have a housing expense for 7 years.
That's huge.
Huge. I
mean, it's huge.
I mean, yeah. Think about this, right? Think about this. Okay. I have some rental properties, right? So I don't know what a $750,000 house in Rehoboth Beach area is going to cost to rent, right? And I'm assuming he's buying a house for $750,000 and not having any outlay of cash, right? Maybe he's going to buy, maybe he has to buy $1 million house, and maybe he's going to have a $250,000 mortgage on the second, you know, whatever. I don't know all the ins and outs of that market, right? But the point is, he doesn't have to pay on $750,000 of debt. So you can actually take that monthly payment now, right? Redirect that to a rental property, say, for example, a cash flow property in another part of state, and use that to generate additional income to leverage it, right? Because I'm a big guy in leverage when it comes to finance and whatever. I mean, there's just so many remarkable things you can do with this, Bradley. It's like, we haven't begun to scratch the surface, and we're about 45 minutes into this podcast.
Yeah, it's a great provision. It really is. And what's even, I think, greater, the provision's great on its own, but when you look at it in the totality of the whole contract, he didn't sign a cheap deal. He's in the 95th percentile of city managers in the Northeast.
Yeah, he didn't trade this for, you know, no. You're right.
No, he did well to kind of bring good value to his contract and to the governing body related to, you know, tenure, and excited for him. You know, definitely he is the first one through the wall, and you know, we'll see. I think others will follow, because it's an issue that's in play in multiple different ways in multiple different places. Housing's gonna be an issue.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about it, others are talking about it, so this is a solution that's going to find its way into other contracts.
And this is something that governing bodies need to be educated about, and this is something that I don't want to dump on the ICMA, but I'm, you know, if the ICMA should be educating governing bodies on some of these aspects about compensation too, in my opinion. But, you know, whatever. I'm not going to go down that road. I will simply say this. You know, I often use the $400,000 price point as the average home, because roughly speaking, the average cost of a home in the country now at this point in time. You know, if you're going to buy and sell that house, right? Because here's the thing that frustrates the hell out of me. City manager, we're supposed to be invested in the community. They want us to live in the community. They want us to be invested in the community until they just want to vote 3-2 to get rid of us. You know, they want us to be invested. Okay. Well, being invested in the community, that requires a lot of money, because if I'm only there for 2 years and I buy a house for $400,000, the odds of the appreciation even going up to the point where I can recoup my transaction costs are not likely, especially in this environment that we're in. We haven't even talked about the interest rate risk that managers are facing right now who have been in jobs over the last few years. Now, if they want to move, they got to pay a higher interest rate, right? I talked to Larry DeRay. He's a city manager out there in that area. Buddy of mine, and he told me recently, like, because he just took a new job, he had to trade a 2-something% mortgage for a 7-something% mortgage, and he has a house that's below the national average. I hope he doesn't mind me saying that, but I mean, that's like an $8,000 hit for him on an annual basis, just on interest rate, just interest rate cost, right?
It matters.
Yeah. So, you know, you sell a $400,000 house, that's going to cost you $25,000 just on real estate agent commissions, just on the commissions, not counting all the other crap you got to do to get your house ready to sell, right? You got to clean it up. You got to do some odds and then fix it. Houses always look the best the day you move out. You know what I mean? When you live in it, it doesn't look that great, right? And then, you know, you've moved around Texas. I don't know exactly, you know, what your experience has been as far as the path in your life, you know, as far as where it stage your life was at, Bradley. But, you know, every time you move, you give away a bunch of crap because you can't sell it or you can't get fair market value for it, and you take a big hit on it, or it's not going to fit in your new place or whatever. So you lose thousands of dollars on the furniture and stuff that you got to sell. It's just a very expensive proposition, never mind the whole hassle and stress of it all. And yeah, it's like, you know, it's like these governing bodies got to understand that we live in a very volatile and transitory profession, and that this is our biggest risk and risk component when it comes to our livelihoods, you know, and never mind all the stress on it. That's something that I think we need to have a greater discussion on as far as advocacy for the profession and for professional managers. And then the other thing, getting back to this contract that I wanted to highlight, this is something I've been kind of fleshing out internally as an idea, but I haven't really got to the point where I really want to publicly, you know, put a bow on it. But I'm just going to have a little bit of a dialogue with you on this, Bradley, is I've often looked at these contracts, for example, in California, where managers are getting these, you know, low interest loans or things of that sort of nature. Sometimes the down payments are like forgiven and, you know, that kind of stuff. City managers need to understand the significance and weight and importance of amortized loans, right? So what happens is when you get a 30-year amortized loan, you are front-loading the interest in the beginning of the first 7 years of that package, of that deal, because you're trying to, in exchange for that level payment over the entire 30 years. But people don't live in houses for 30 years. And it's a really silly concept. It's a really archaic concept, in my opinion. And when you actually factor in the cost of, say, an interest-only loan, we're far ahead. Like, I would advocate, if you can't even get this deal, let's say you can't get a deal where you're getting a forgivable loan, which is an amazing deal. And I've been trying to, I would do this in my next gig if I can, you know, whatever my next gig is going to be. But I would ask for example, an interest only loan. And I would just say, hey, how about this? I would love a zero interest loan, obviously, if I could get that. I would start, you know, first I would start with this deal that, you know, I would start with this deal, right? Since this is the new kind of like new standard, right? And I would shoot for 0% interest, right? And then I would go with interest only, right? Because imagine if you have an interest only loan on $400,000 versus a 7% 30-year amortized, you're going to waste thousands of dollars. I did the calculation on Taylor's house, right? Let's just say he did a 10% down payment on a $750,000 house, right? A typical kind of setup. And so you're basically financing $675,000 over the course of 30 years. You know, you're dropping $315,000 in that 7 years just on interest, Bradley. Now, imagine if you just had an interest-only loan and you were just paying the interest and you could basically pay down your principal instead of wasting it on the amortized interest that's front loaded. I'm sorry, getting into a little finance nerd rant, but
I think we as city managers need to talk about that stuff, because at least for me, often I'm the last person to get served in any sense. And we can get personal on you for a minute.
Please. But
we work our tails off for our community, for our governing body. And when we get home, if you got a family or not, I do. I have three kids and a wife. there's not a lot left for them. There's not a lot left for financial management of my portfolio because I'm busting it for the city of Waco. And that's what I signed up for. But in forums like this, we need to be talking about it so that we're not every city manager is having to learn that lesson that you just taught on finance on their own after they've done three house deals. Let's talk about it early.
Yeah.
And learn from each other so that, you know, we don't have to learn it on our own the hard way. Because I do feel like managers, they get home and there's not a lot left. There's not a lot left for this type of conversation or their families or their, you know, if they have faith, that they put so much into their lives as city managers that they, you know, there's not much left in the tank when they get home.
Great point, Bradley. That's a very,
so that's a place where you have this forum that you've created, where you can create value for managers.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. You're right. I guess I'll just do a little teaser now. I wasn't planning on doing it, but May 1st, I've talked about me and Micah Gaudet having a special announcement we're going to make. I would just say to the folks listening, stay tuned for that. Me and Micah have some big plans, some big ideas, some grandiose ideas that are that we think are going to kind of change the game a little bit. So stay tuned for that. So Bradley, you know, we're about the hour in here. We've had a really healthy discussion. I love this discussion. I think it's going to be very informative and useful for the audience who's listening. Why don't we turn now and pivot to what you're doing with City Compensation? Tell the folks how to reach you. Tell them what you're doing. Just kind of give an opportunity for you to share to the folks like what you're doing and how you can help them.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. So I have created a business and it's all around local government compensation. We just released our first spring report. So 1,000 cities, 14,000 jobs. And you can go take a look at it on citycompensation.com. It is the largest collection of local government leadership compensation data that exists.
Bar none.
Yeah, not even close, right? I mean, taking a bunch of work to get it and put it together. The folks that have bought it already gotten great response from that, wow, this is a lot, and did not realize that a resource like this was out there. So getting great feedback so far from folks that have bought it. You know, it can tell you where you need to be on your next department head search, whether, you know, what the market rate is in your region, in your state, at the MSA level, at the national level, any geography you want. It'll tell you where you need to be. If you want to attract candidates out of a certain region, it'll give you a sense. For instance, like in Texas, there are a couple of MSAs that just have really low rates of pay. And so if you're watching LinkedIn and you see somebody that's just killing it and doing great in their community, and they're from a certain region that you know doesn't pay a lot, you can go grab them. You can go say, hey, I really like what you're doing. I've got a role here. Here's what we pay. And I've used it to recruit passive candidates, frankly. The way this all came about.
This is you're putting on right now a master's class in city management 101, or not, maybe not 101, maybe 401. I don't know, Bradley, because you're hitting on a very important function of being thoughtful and proactive and say, hey, you know what? I have a need to fill these vacancies. I have a talent shortage. How do I find the talent? Well, the way you find that talent is locate the talent that you think is great. And it doesn't take a rocket science to say, hey, if they're over this MSA and they're getting paid 40% less than what I can pay or 30% or whatever it is, man, go out and proactively go get them.
Yeah, go get them. And I think we kind of, a lot of people in local government, not everybody, but we've just said, hey, we're just going to go do the normal thing. We're going to go hire a search firm, a big name, and they're going to go find us a great candidate. Well, that's not the only way to do this, especially if you're armed with some intel. You can go out and passively recruit. Absolutely. Or you don't have to just send the mass email.
Yes.
Like go talk to people, go engage like you and I have been doing for a couple of years now on LinkedIn. I've got people I've been talking to for 5 years on LinkedIn because I know what kind of person they are. I'm just waiting for those circumstances to align to say, hey, I've got a role for you. You're creative. I'm creative. We should do some creative stuff together.
And the crazy thing is, Bradley, all the information you have is public record, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But it takes such a monumental amount of work and energy to compile it into a useful database and repository of information that you have, that you essentially are giving these managers like the e-ticket or the shortcut or the carpool lane to go identify talent and be like, okay, this person, I can go get this person.
Yeah. The other thing we're doing, the tagline, right, is recruit the best talent, retain the best talent, because there are also communities that are underpaying their current department heads and ACMs, and they don't realize it. And it's because we spend a lot of time thinking about pay, internal equity on pay. So like my police chief needs to make about what the fire chief makes and the CFO. And then I have this other group of directors that need to be paid the same. No, that's not how it works. An IT director should not be paid the same or anywhere near the same as your communications director. They have two very different market values, but a lot of managers pay them the same because there's internal equity conversation around it. Well, this product gives them much more exposure to like, what is the market value of each of these positions across, again, like across any geography or population grouping. And because I'll see people that pay, for instance, their development director at the 92nd percentile of their of that position, but then you look at their library director and they're making 40%, or they're at the 40 percentile. And what the report, the deep dive report, challenges them to do is set a number that you like. So you want to pay people at the median or at 75th percentile or whatever number is right, and then pay each of the positions at that percentile so that you've got a defendable strategy of why you're paying them that amount.
But there's two components to that. So you're saying, it's almost like you're saying on internally, the range should be on a set on the market for that position. And then internally you can set the pay structure on a percentage of that range that's equal across the board. And then you have some maneuverability based off of competency, based off of their level of performance, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So like your best talent, you know, I mean, every manager has to go through this. The people you cannot have walk out the door, you may just have to put them a few notches up because you're not gonna be able to replace them. So you're right on with the two frameworks, and also just the discretion that a manager needs to have to say, all right, I'm going to pay this person at the 95th percentile because they're managing a $200 million bond program and I can't
afford to lose them.
Can't afford to lose them.
Yeah. And if you can't afford to lose them, then that tells you that if they're in the same pay range structure as another person who you can't afford to lose, then there's a problem there and you need to be intentional about solving that problem.
Yeah. And that's what I think is cool about what we put together on this tool for a long time. And a lot of managers do this. They rely upon, you know, just peer city data and 10 to 12 cities to decide what they're going to pay their people. Well, we've got a solution that gives you way more access to data and way more exposure. And the way I've been talking to people about it is, if you set your comp on 10 to 12 peer cities, would you take the same approach of only recruiting from those 10 to 12 cities? No, you're going to recruit from everywhere.
Right.
You're going to recruit where you want to recruit from. So you need to have exposure to compensation all over the place instead of just a few cities. And that's really resonated with some folks. The other thing, you know, that's resonated with people is when you buy the product, you get access to the city manager report that I've been referring to in our discussion. That's a freebie that I throw in for folks that buy the report. And it's going to be very helpful for managers to say, when they go back in for a performance review, like, this is market-based. This is not me asking for some crazy benefit.
Right.
Most of my peers get this benefit.
Yes. So, and they have a third party data source to support the argument. This isn't just you pulling, this isn't city manager John Smith in the triangle pulling his choice comps. This is literally you giving the data.
And that's just not something we've had access to. It's just, as managers, we don't have it. And we may have read a friend's contract, or we may have a former boss that had given a contract. But other than that, there's nothing at scale.
That's right. That's right.
And And so this is kind of my love language is data. So it has taken a lot of work, but I feel like it's a way I can give something of value to the profession. So whether or not you buy it, if you're a city manager out there, whether or not you buy the spring report or whatever, you know, if you just want to talk to me or talk to Joe, I know Joe's the same way. Like if you just want to talk about your contract and where you're weak or where you want to grow, drop me a note on email. It's bradley@citycompensation.com. And I know Joe does the same for people. Like it's a way that I can be open-handed with the information I have and support managers.
That's right.
Because we've got a hard enough gig. This is a resource that can really help.
Absolutely. You know, Bradley, I've talked for about over a year now about a paradigm shift coming to the profession, city management, city management, county management profession. I believe you are part of that paradigm shift. I believe that I and Micah are part of that paradigm shift. I believe that Taylor Tedder is now part of that paradigm shift because I've talked about problems with compensation and what have you. We are on a new frontier. It's exciting to me because we're in 2024 and I just see a lot of potential ahead. So I call myself an expert on compensation, but you are the expert on public sector compensation at this point. Mm-hmm. And thank you for coming on the show to share your thoughts with us. If you are interested in Bradley's products, his service, again, go to citycompensation.com. And if you do buy a product, I would greatly appreciate if you shared with him that you heard about it here on the podcast, because we're here to help each other out. We're here to build community. And I want to help him. I want to help those who are listening. He wants to help people. And we're all about being in this together and building that community, that network of professionals who are trying to help each other out, support each other. And I'm going to wrap it up with that. So I don't know if you have any more final comments, Bradley, but thank you for coming on the show to help deconstruct Taylor Tedder's contract. I think it was a very valuable and useful conversation. And I'll give you the last word, bud.
All right. Only thing I got to say is keep up the good work, Joe. We need voices in this space, and really, really appreciate you giving me the time today. But more so appreciate like what you're doing for local government, and can't wait to hear what you're doing in May with Micah. I'll be on pins and needles till then, but just keep up the great work.
Thanks, brother. Thank you very much. With that, I will say goodbye. I am Joe Turner. This is the City Manager Unfiltered Podcast. If you appreciate the content I'm putting out there, please take a moment to hit the follow and subscribe button, and also to rate and review the podcast, especially those Apple users. I would greatly appreciate it. Catch you on the next episode. Thank you very much.